Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Welcome, everybody, to IGN Unfiltered, our monthly long-form interview show where it is my goal to find the most interesting people and the things they've done in the video game industry and talk to them about it, because turns out some of the most interesting stories in the video game world aren't the games themselves, but in my opinion, the people behind them. This is one such man. His name is Greg Canessa. You may remember that name. It may ring a bell. You've been at PopCap, you've been at Blizzard, you've been at Activision, but you mostly came to my attention in your days at Microsoft. You were there in the beginning of the Xbox days, and you are, my friend, the creator, the primary creator with your team of Xbox Live Arcade.
Yeah.
That, which remains one of my favorite things about the Xbox ecosystem of all time.
Thank you.
So, but you were telling me before we got started, and so I just want to start right here. You were telling me that Xbox Live Arcade almost didn't get off the ground.
Yeah, that's right. It was not part of the plan for Xbox or Xbox 360 at all. And that's kind of one of the lesser known facts in the console space nowadays. While you know we all think about it as the game service that we've kind of come to know and love over the last 10 years or so. It was a project that came in very late in the planning cycle for Xbox 360, the very end of OG Xbox, and it was it wasn't really supposed to happen, and it almost didn't happen.
So, okay, well, the easy next question.
Yeah,
what happens behind the scenes where it almost doesn't happen?
Yeah, I mean, you know, really, Xbox Live Arcade was an idea that we came up with and wrote the business plan in late 2003. Really, there were a few different phenomena that were going on at the time. If you were to kind of rewind mentally back to 2003,
Xbox Live was launching.
That's right. Xbox Live launched in 2002. You know, first ever real sort of console downloadable or real game service, so to speak.
Yeah.
Not really downloadable per se, but you know, voice chat and multiplayer gaming and so forth. We'd launched and we had seen some really early success there, which was great. There were a lot of other things going on in the industry at the same time that really created kind of this perfect storm of opportunity that inspired the creation of Xbox Live Arcade. You had the indie game movement just starting to happen on the PC. You had iTunes and the iPod come about, and for the first time, sort of digital distribution of content was becoming legit for people. You had retro gaming starting to flourish and come back, both with the kind of compilation packs from Midway and Namco Museum, that type of stuff. You remember those? And then MAME was happening on the PC at the same time. And then you had this casual gaming thing with companies like PopCap and Gamehouse and others, you know, on these PC web portals and these downloadable games, try before you buy, $20 game experiences like Bejeweled and Zuma and those types of things were happening. And they all kind of conspired into this idea behind, wow, what if we opened up the console for the first time ever, leveraged this pipeline that we created, this bandwidth, you know, this pipe that we'd created around Xbox Live, where we had broadband in the box to deliver full game content through Xbox Live. And so sat down, wrote a business plan for it. It was really a two-phase business plan.
Okay.
Phase one was sort of OG Xbox.
Right, because it actually launched with Ms. Pac-Man as a
$15
thing. It was like, what? They're trying to sell me Ms. Pac-Man for $15? I don't understand this.
Yeah, that was really the experiment. I mean, that was really the precursor to the thing we really wanted to do, which was the Xbox 360 version. The OG Xbox version of XBLA is what we affectionately refer to as the version no one knew about. Because of the limitations of OG Xbox at the time, we called it Xbox One at the time, ironically.
Right.
As you know.
Had to retcon that one.
Exactly. that was a great console, and while it was designed with that broadband port, you know, for Xbox Live, when we launched in 2002, we didn't really anticipate that we would be doing doing a lot of things in the dashboard. If you recall, there was kind of that green sort of screen.
Oh, yeah.
There wasn't a whole lot. There was sort of a profile and setup. There were some very simple things for voice chat, but it wasn't really designed to be software upgradable. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't really integrate something like an Xbox Live Arcade into the dashboard.
Okay.
So what we had to do is we had to roll XBLA, and the first incarnation of it, on a disk. And
ironically.
So, ironically. And boy, I'll tell you, the challenge of getting people to actually get that disk in their hands was really, really tough for us, right? We were polybagging it into magazines. We were giving it away at, you know, trade shows. We were, you know, bundling it in with the console. But, you know, we were trying like hell to try and get this disc into people's hands. One of the things we did was we bundled with Ms. Pac-Man. So that was the kind of pack-in game, if you will, as an incentive for people to try it out. But you had to have the disc in the tray, close it to pull up the Xbox Live Arcade dash, if you will, and select the games. But even if you downloaded something onto your hard drive, you had to go root around and find that disc and stick it in to play the games that you had on your hard drive. So it was a little wonky. Nonetheless, we did get a small crop of consumers in there, small group of gamers in there.
Yeah.
And we shipped about 20 games in there. Namco was our early partner, of course, not only Ms. Pac-Man, but we shipped Pole Position and Galaga. PopCap was an early partner, Game House. There were a number of different sort of indie games that we shipped. And that was what we saw with, albeit a small audience, was incredible.
So how does it almost not happen when it?
So we had that early early version. It launched, by the way, November 9th, 2004. You recall what that date is?
I of course remember it, but I don't remember it launching the same day.
Yeah,
as Halo
you probably
2
don't. It was the same day as Halo 2, and it was a little more notable.
I guess I was maybe distracted by
Halo 2
a little bit.
But we launched it then. We saw that, you know, that download to purchase conversion rate, because, you know, every game had a demo. That was a key
right.
principle of it. And we saw that conversion rate at 8.5 times that of what we were seeing on the PC at the time,
wow.
which was phenomenal. So that was an early sort of, the experiment was a success. We knew we were on to something. So what happened was, when I wrote the initial, just to back up a little bit, when I wrote the initial business plan for XBLA, I went around and pitched it to a lot of different executives that were at Microsoft at the time. And remember, this was an idea that came out of left field. No one had planned on it. Wasn't part of the Xbox One plan. Wasn't part of the 360 plan, which was called Xenon at the time.
So, caveat, when he says Xbox One for the rest of the show, he's talking about the original
OG Xbox, right, sorry, OG Xbox. The OG Xbox, you know, again, not part of that plan, not part of the 360 plan, which at the time was codenamed Xenon.
Right.
And so the team was already hard at work on that, but we were still working on OG Xbox as well. So wrote the plan, pitched it to a bunch of different executives. It was like, thanks, but no thanks. It was just me, like, random guy. Hey, you know, working there, obviously, working on the online games group. But it was cool, but, you know, nah. And so pitched 5 different executives at the company. All of them shot it down until I got to Jay Allard. And Jay Allard, some of you guys know.
Mastermind behind the 360, more or less.
Mastermind behind the 360, absolutely. And he was a gracious executive sponsor. He funded a small team and a small content budget to get the Xbox, the OG Xbox version, off the ground as an experiment. Mm-hmm. And of course, the business plan articulated a kind of a two-phase plan. Like,
sure,
we'll launch this, and if it's successful, then we had much more ambitious plans for the 360 version. So, so funded that, launched it, got the, you know, the experiment. The experiment was a success, and then of course tried to get the 360 version developed. And by then it was, you know, November, December, you know, December of 2004.
Four, right.
And we were 11 months from ship of the console.
But you got a lock before.
You got a lock, right? Far before that, right? There's, when you're building a console, of course, you have not only the hardware, but you have that system software that goes and needs to be on a flash, flashed in to be resident in the, you know, in the memory of the console. And that needs to ship, that needs to go to the, you know, the manufacturing facility in China needs to be tested and so forth. So that software needed to be done in August of 2004 and 2005 to launch in November. And so the team was crunched. And the Book of Xenon, again, didn't have anything XBLA in there. There were plans for achievements and voice chat. And a marketplace that, albeit was kind of a smaller marketplace, it was really for more hats and swords and, you know, add-on content to retail games, but really didn't have a demo mechanism, didn't have a what we call the license key trial model, and where you could kind of buy something and it would be tied to your account in the sky, and then right. you could roam with it. That didn't exist. And then, of course, this downloadable game concept of XBLA wasn't there either. And so it was December of 2014. 2004. Sorry, yes, 2004. I'm mixing my dates up here, but December is actually December 10th of 2004. I'll never forget the meeting. It was a Friday, and I got to meet with Jay in his office, and Cam Froney, who was the head of kind of the Xbox software team at the time, Xbox Live and the Xbox software team for the Dash. We sat down. I had prepared a slide deck that was Tyler and Heidi, these kind of scenarios for, you know, the guy gamer and then the woman, you know, girlfriend that also might be interested in Xbox 360 but wanted a different type of content, maybe a smaller right. game or a more casual game or a retro game. Walk through the plan with him. Of course, Jay had already funded the OG version of XBLA, so he was familiar with it. But I just had 7 people on the team, very small development budget. And I pitched the plan to fully integrate the full vision, which is to fully integrate XBLA into the Dash, make it that destination, which was a key part of the vision mm-hmm. for Xbox Live Arcade, for your content, staff it up and integrate it. And
so did he say no?
No, so Cam said no. So love Cam, but he was under the gun at the time, and he had 9 months effectively to ship the Flash, and right. he said, listen, I can't do this. Like, my team's booked. We don't even know. Like, it's going to be dicey to even make the date. We've got achievements, and we've got gamer score, and we've got all these other things to integrate. Mm-hmm. I have no time to do this. I can't deal with it. No. And Jay took a look at it, and I remember sitting in the chair across from him, right next to his Robotron machine he had in his office. And he was a big Eugene Jarvis fan. He said, no. This needs to be integrated into the dashboard. Greg, you will get your funding. Cam, you'll work with Greg and his team. We will find a way to get this done. It needs to be in the Dash. This is a key part of what we want to do with Xbox 360. It's a key part of the vision for where I want to go with Xbox Live. Greg, you have your funding, and we will work with you, and we'll figure out a way to get this done.
So Jay Allard could see the future in this case.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He was the visionary behind Xbox Live. He always was, right? Hero protagonist.
His gamer
big,
tag.
Big,
yeah.
That's right. Big Snow Crash fan, and he saw the potential of Xbox Live Arcade all the way back. He was the guy to actually announce the OG Xbox version of it back in E3 2004 for the original one. Mm-hmm. He remembers the crowd's reaction when we were talking about, you know, having small games, indie games, casual games on the console, and he was always a big believer. So he gave me a team, a slightly larger team. I had 11 people. I went up from 7. Gave me another content development budget.
50% more people in that case, right?
50% more people. And the interesting thing about it was organizationally how we're structured at Microsoft, you know, we're split into a bunch of different teams. And so there's Microsoft Game Studios or Microsoft Studios now.
Right.
There was the Live team. There was the hardware team. There was the services team. My team was kind of, at the time, was separated from the core sort of Live software development team. And so that ended up being a blessing in disguise.
Right, you were rogue.
We were rogue.
Oh, operate in the shadows.
Totally.
No one knows.
We were off to the side, and you know, God knows we had our share of detractors, which we can get into. But one of the benefits of that was we were able to stay heads down on not only sort of the Xbox content portfolio for XBLA, the initial sort of 20 games we had in the launch window, but also there's a bunch of platform back-end sort of technology that had to happen. And then the dashboard, you know, the front-end, what
sure.
we call the client experience.
Yeah, the front-facing stuff.
The front-facing stuff. And because we were separated, we were able to help out and pitch in and help the Xbox Live team make their August date. So not only did we build the Xbox Live button, if you will, but we built that Games Blade. Remember the Blade model?
Everybody remembers the Blade super fondly.
That's right.
Absolutely.
The Games Blade was my team, as well as about a third of the marketplace. We ended up blowing out the marketplace to be much larger than it was. and the demo key license model, that whole model around the demo that you would be able to download, and then there would be a license that was attached to it without having to re-download the whole thing, like that whole thing, and then you could put it on a memory card and roam over to your friend's house, and there'd be a key in the sky, and you'd always have rights to your games. Like, all that stuff was all the Xbox Live Arcade team.
So it launches built into the 360. You guys make it.
Right.
But, and you've got, arguably the original killer app was Geometry Wars.
Yeah.
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
So how easy or difficult was it to sell developers on the idea of Live Arcade? So we've got this new ecosystem. It's all digital. There's a 50 megabyte cap to start with.
Yeah.
Was it even less at the time?
It was 50 megabyte cap initially.
Yep. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. So how was it selling developers on the idea of this thing?
Yeah, you know, it was not a hard sell, to be honest with you. We went out there, and there were a couple things. Number one, there was just natural interest in this from the retro guys. Again, they were having a tough time sort of getting mindshare in the large publisher model, right?
And nobody was probably, most people were most likely pirating their retro games,
right?
Nobody's making money off of them.
That's right. Nobody's making money off of them. That was a fairly easy sell. You know, one thing you got to remember back at the time was, up until Xbox Live Arcade, this predates everything. It predates Steam, predates the iTunes store, the App Store on iOS or Android. It predates everything. PlayStation Network, WiiWare, nothing existed. This was the very first one. And so at the time, the console was a very closed model. The console, you had to work through a publisher, what's called a PLA, a publisher license agreement, in order to get your content published. And unless you're this huge multi-million dollar, or multi-billion dollar entity, and you work through their pipeline, you weren't getting your content on a console, period. You just couldn't. So there was the moment we sort of had hinted to the community that we were going to open the platform, they were caught a little bit off guard with the XBLA, the OG Xbox version, right? No one knew.
Right.
That was kind of a secret project. Once we had, in the time, that year span between the OG Xbox version and the 360 implementation, the community was like, wow. The casual game providers were like, wow, we can get our content onto the console? Wow, really? The indie game providers were like, oh my God, we're struggling over here on the PC. And remember, there was no Steam. So these guys were trying to rely on websites to distribute their games. They were embracing it almost instantly.
So who were these detractors that you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of people, surprisingly enough, there were a lot of people, as I mentioned, a lot of executives said thanks, but no thanks. There were a lot of people internally that were very skeptical about XBLA or didn't want it to happen for various reasons. The reasons were, one reason I heard was no one wants to play those types of games on a console. Like, casual games, really? Indie games, what are those? Like, no one wants to play those
when
games.
When Uno went on to become, like, a multi-million selling game.
Yeah, not to mention, Castle Crashers and Limbo and Braid and Minecraft and so many other things, right, that came after it. So no one wants to play those games. Right. I heard that a lot. Xbox has no business being in the content distribution space of games. Like, who is it for us as a platform provider to provide a content distribution pipeline for games? That's other people's roles. That's the role of publishers. There were others that felt like we had no business picking and choosing games. We should be completely agnostic. So remember, Xbox at the time was a nascent business, right?
For
Microsoft, and just we were the new kid in town.
We're trying to get your foot in the door.
We were trying to get our foot in the door. We were taking a lot of our keys, and you've talked to Seamus and others before, right? We were taking our keys and our notes from Sony and Nintendo. And there was this concept of you need to be agnostic as a platform provider, right? And you need to treat everyone equally. And so, a key component of the vision behind Xbox Live Arcade, and I can't emphasize this enough, one component was the dedicated destination, which we'll talk about, right? But the other was curation. And this concept of people are busy. This is almost like the radio record company model.
Is that where Live Arcade Wednesdays and Summer of Arcade came from?
Absolutely it was. And from the outset, from the original OG Xbox, a key component of the business plan behind Xbox Live Arcade was these are small games, low to no small development budgets, low to no marketing budgets.
Right.
And it's not up to us to sort of just, people are busy. They have all kinds of stuff going on in their day. Wading through 15 crappy poker games to find the one good one, people don't have time for that. Let us help you. Let's wade through the crap and get to the games that people actually want to play. Let's put them, you know, in the dashboard, and then let's promote them, and let's market them, and let's help these indies, let's help these casual game providers actually get some mind share out there
and
relative to retail games.
It was a mandate. Every single live arcade game had a free trial.
Had a free trial
to it.
That
was that part of the vision as well?
Absolutely.
Because that, I mean, I don't know if you're at liberty to share the conversion rates, but I've got to think that that paid off big time.
Oh, it absolutely paid off big time.
So particularly when you're talking about games that had, as you said, no marketing and minimal budgets, where people aren't going to know about them or what they are otherwise, right?
That was absolutely a key component of the vision from the get-go, from the OG Xbox version. It was every game has a free demo. Because, again, this is about lowering barriers to entry. This is about, you know, exposing people to cool content that they might want to play with at a low price point, making it accessible. Remember, they haven't read about it. They haven't heard about it. There was, websites or, you know, there weren't a lot of reviews for these games at the time.
Right.
There certainly were no marketing budgets or ads or anything. So what's the best way to infect people with the vision of what your game is all about than to have them play a version of it? So the demo model was key to the original vision of the Xbox from the get-go. And so, you know, the dedicated destination, every game has a demo, lower price points, $5, $10, $15, that was part of it. Developers keep the majority of the revenue. Again, we went in with the revenue
70,
share model.
70-30 split, right?
70-30 split.
Which predated all those other services you mentioned, right?
And that's a funny story, right? I remember the meeting where we were talking about the PLA, what we call the PLA, the Publisher License Agreement, which is the kind of the contract that Microsoft has with, and Sony has one, and Nintendo
right.
has one. This is very
yeah.
well known. With different publishers. When you want to be a publisher, you know, there's kind of contractual terms around revenue share split.
Sure.
And I remember the meeting explicitly when we had come up with 70-30 as the split.
70 to the developer, 30 to Microsoft.
70 to the developer, 30 to Microsoft. And at the time, we had no idea that that actually was setting a precedent for the entire games industry. You know, the iTunes App Store, everyone ended up adopting that, right? Because PSN adopted 70-30, WiiWare adopted 70-30, and then when the Apple guys, started up the iTunes App Store, they had keyed off of, remember, all the developers were the same developers, the same indies and casual
True.
Providers, et cetera. They had all said, well, 70-30 is what we get on consoles, and so Apple said, okay. We had no idea that little meeting we had in Millennium by the gravel pit was like the rev share split archetype for, you know, the next 10 years of downloadable software. But, you know, those are, that's one of the benefits of working at Microsoft, right? It's a magical place. You're the platform provider, and the decisions you make, you know, especially as a passionate hardcore gamer, you know, you can make these little decisions and in a small way contribute to the industry in a major way.
So
that's so fun.
You once said in Official Xbox Magazine, where I used to work, mm-hmm. we did a feature piece on Live Arcade as it had taken off with the early 360 days.
Yeah.
You said, Xbox Live Arcade is not a place for your old-ass PS1 games.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Meaning, you know, how I interpreted that at the time was you were wanting to not just have it be a port house and have it, you know, have
That's
a lot
right.
of original content, but where did that statement come from you, and are you proud that Live Arcade pretty well indeed held true to that in your time there?
Absolutely, and you know, once again, I'll say it wasn't just me. Obviously, I had an incredible team of people that I worked with for many years who built this service together, and then obviously continued it even after I left Microsoft. That was key to the vision behind Xbox Live Arcade, was shoring up the walls of what it was and what it wasn't. You remember, again, those forces, those title forces within Microsoft, and even within the development community about what this could be.
Yeah.
You can imagine how people would want to naturally pull it in a bunch of different directions. Once we have a digital distribution pipeline on a console now, wow, let's shove all kinds of stuff in there. Old retail games
right.
and schlocky stuff and poor quality stuff.
Right.
And
muddy it up such that no one would want to use it anymore.
Muddy it up, which comes back to this concept of curation. It was about us having a specific vision for what this service was and wasn't, which was about indie games, casual games, retro games, small games, games that didn't otherwise have a voice.
Right.
In some ways, it was kind of the democratization of console gaming. That was the vision behind Xbox Live Arcade. And there were a lot of people internally that really had an issue with that. Right? You know, they really, just to be honest, they didn't understand it at the time. I don't fault them now, I mean, in hindsight, but I can understand we were in the process of building a platform, right, for the future, and a console, and our presence in the console space with the OG Xbox. A lot of these decisions were made that far back. We were only in the console business for a couple of years. And at the time, there was a fear that if we didn't do anything that a large publisher wanted us to do, that we'd be pissing them off and they'd go away, or that we'd blow up our own console. I mean, these were real fears. There was a legitimate fear that Xbox Live Arcade was going to cannibalize retail sales and completely destroy the console industry. That was actually a quote I got from one of the internal folks.
The harbinger of death for the entire industry.
The harbinger of death for the entire industry. It was all going to go to hell, and everyone was going to be buying. We were going to ruin price
Braid
points.
Braid and everything Limbo will kill everything.
Yeah, $5 and $10 price points. It was going to completely destroy the sort of economic model of console retail publishing and destroy the industry. And we were just like, no, of course. Some of us were like, of course that's not going to happen. But it was important to that, and that's why I made quotes like that, even publicly, and I stand behind those quotes to this day. What we were trying to do was we were trying to set people's expectations externally within the industry and internally at Microsoft that this was about certain types of games and this wasn't about other types of games.
So how far, you know, you mentioned that Live Arcade was this success that even, you know, you believed in it, your team believed in it, but then it just took off.
Yeah.
How far, is there a way that you can sort of, in a tangible story, crystallize how far it exceeded those expectations? Like, I don't know if you necessarily can or want to give numbers, but was there a point where you woke up and went, oh man.
Oh shit.
Like this is a whole new animal here.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple things that come to mind. So Xbox Live Arcade, as I mentioned, wasn't part of the plan. So because it wasn't part of the plan, Microsoft is a large company and has a huge machine. This is a multi-billion dollar investment we were making behind 360.
Right.
And we had the Book of Xenon, which you've heard of before. This is kind of Bible of like what 360 was going to be.
That's Jay's 33, Robbie and Jay's 33 pager. Is that correct?
Exactly.
The 33 pager and the 333.
Right. So this was the 33 pager on what it was and what it wasn't. It wasn't part of that, right? There was no chapter for XBLA in because it was late entry. And so because of that, the mind share wasn't there internally. We were the little engine that could off to the side, the small team. And the PR and marketing machine also hadn't picked up on it until very late in the game. They finally did. You know, guys like Aaron Greenberg and Albert Pinello and some of the folks that are still there were early fans of XBLA and saw the potential. And so in partnership with me and my team, we were able to finally get a little bit of mind share from a PR standpoint right before the launch of 360 in November of 2005.
Yep.
So there was a press tour that we did. It was New York and San Francisco same day. So New York was more sort of consumer oriented. And
yeah, late September, as I remember.
Late September, around that time frame. And I was in the New York one, and you know, a couple of members of my team were in the San Francisco one, and we had rolled out. This was the big okay. You get to check out the Dash. You get to check out Live.
Yeah, Perfect Dark.
PGR. Cameo.
All this stuff. Yep.
Call of Duty 2.
Yep.
Right, which is a launch title.
Huge.
With the volumetric fog. Yep. I remember everyone was freaking out about.
Yeah.
And we had spent, obviously, a ton of time, Microsoft Game Studios, a ton of time building out those games. We'd spent a lot of money.
Only tens of millions of dollars.
Only tens of millions of dollars, right, on those things. And we had this little kiosk in the corner. There was, like, rows, if you've been to many of these events, right, rows of these demo stations with all these different, you know, all the different launch titles, et cetera, first and third party. And there was a station in the corner.
Geometry Wars.
There was Geometry Wars on it. And I was manning the little station in the corner. And that was the first time that the press had ever seen this. And a couple days later, you know, the embargo was lifted and, you know, people were writing their stories. And I kid you not, over half of the consumer press stories that we got were about Xbox Live Arcade and Geometry Wars. That's all people wanted to talk about. And of course, much to the dismay of some of the people internally, of course, probably pissed a few of them off a little bit, but I mean, they were like, oh my God, these small games, this is what I want. A lot of people are not, you know, they're not all hard, super hardcore, just Call of Duty. This was about the enormous potential of original content and casual games and other things that people were seeing. And so they immediately went to it. And we had a hint. There was that. Of course, there was the announcement at E3. That was an early hint. But then when we launched, with 10 titles day one.
Yeah, it was a lot. Outpost, remember? Koloki X. Some of the old Midway titles,
Games, right? Gauntlet, Joust, Robotron, Smash TV. We had PopCap there with Bejeweled and Zuma. We had...
Ninja Bee's game.
Mutant Storm. Yeah. There's Mutant Storm from Pom Pom. There was Marble Blast Ultra from Garage Games. Ninja Bee was there with Outpost Koloki X. Later on, they did Cloning Clyde.
That's it. That's
the that was in the launch window. So we had 20 for launch window. We made 10 for launch day.
Right.
I was at Zero Hour, so my team
the
and I... The thing in the desert in Lancaster, the big... The big hangar out there, and we had our big zero-hour things. It was a 24-hour shift. There was no sleeping. It was literally a 24-hour party. We had one thing over in the corner, mobbed, and we launched the thing. And I can't tell you anything other than it was probably the most magical period of my entire career.
So you probably had projections for what you expected.
We did.
Download-wise, in the first day or first week or first month, whatever it was. By what order of magnitude were those exceeded?
Well, let me put it this way. We had a business plan that it outlined, 12-month projections for downloads, conversion, and revenue, from the service like everyone did. We hit those by week three. So within 3 weeks, we had done our entire first year's numbers, and by the following month... We were still shipping the other 10 games in our launch portfolio, some of which we had subsidized, right, to kind of get the thing out the door and bootstrap some indies that we thought had really awesome games. We had 80 developers in the planning stages in our pipeline for developing games, and not one of them wanted funding. Like, we had people that were... They were beg, borrowing, and stealing to get onto XBLA. We had large publishers come in that didn't want to even return our phone calls. They were like... Where do we? They went from maybe we'll do an experiment to we're going to set up a division to do XBLA games. This thing went completely wacky practically overnight. It was a magical time. I mean, a couple of crazy stories. Some of the developers that I got to meet with. Everyone from Mizuguchi to, of course, Alexei Pajitnov, that's a whole story in and of itself. Alexei Pajitnov, the creator of Tetris, was actually working in my group for other reasons. He'd been at Microsoft Game Studios working on some retail games for Ed Freeze that they had shipped, old casual PC games, doing puzzle games, was working there at the time. One of the things that inspired me was my Game Boy and Tetris. Tetris is a pack-in game.
Yeah.
It was a killer app. And so in the original business plan from late 2003, I had a pack-in game as a key component of XBLA. So we came time to do the 360 version. I said, I really want to build this pack-in game that was going to be kind of a killer app, and we could ship it just like we did with Ms. Pac-Man as kind of a trial to get people familiar with this concept. Remember, foreign concept.
Oh,
download
yeah.
a game, save to your hard drive, launch it without a disk. Weird, right? So we came up with this idea, and Alexei was just working in the studios at the time, met with Alexei, and he came up with the idea for Hexic. And it ended up being... The first crazy story, it was the very first game in the history of Xbox 360 to ever be certified, because it was our pack-in game.
Yeah, it had to ship on every
hard drive. Every hard drive, and we shipped it. And it was originally supposed to be like just the first 500,000 consoles, and we ended up keeping it on for like 20 million consoles or something. It was like ridiculous. We just kept Hexic on the hard drive because it was this huge hit.
It was a great game.
Everybody loved it, and Alexei deserves a ton of credit. I mean, after Tetris, of course, he's a legend for Tetris.
There was a Hexic 2, even.
There was even a sequel we did to it.
Sequel.
Later on. So that was a key component of it as well. And I got to work with, literally, Tim Train and Brian Reynolds, of Big Huge Games fame, Mizuguchi, Sid Meier, Tim Schafer. I mean, you name it. They were all coming. Not all of them did games, but many of them ended up doing games on the service. Like, Tim and Brian ended up doing Catan. You remember Settlers
of
Catan for XBLA? That was Big Huge Games.
Yeah.
That was the guys that did Rise of Nations that did that game. Mizuguchi, of course, did Luminous Live for us.
Which was enormous.
Richard Garfield did Schizoid. Well, I got to meet Richard Garfield. He's actually a personal friend of mine now. We met through those days. And he did Schizoid, and of course he did Magic the Gathering, the many editions of Magic the Gathering. People were just coming out, some of the biggest names, the Epic guys, I got to know those guys, and of course Chair and
Shadow Complex.
Shadow Complex later
well,
on.
That sort of brings me to my next
incredible.
Question is, you know, you're smart enough to say, okay, we've got trials for every game so that these things that people might not know about but might seem intriguing, they can just try it, and then they might buy it. So you've got that in place. You've been smart enough to say, okay, we've got Xbox Live Arcade Wednesdays, where every mm-hmm. Wednesday we're going to curate mm-hmm. some cool stuff for you.
Yep.
So we knew to expect that. Like, what's going to be the game? What's going to be this Wednesday's game?
Yeah.
So where does... And then you say you've got like 80 developers jumping on after the thing takes off. So where does Summer of Arcade come into the picture? Because that's... Summer of Arcade became... I mean, right away, the first one was huge. The first one was arguably the best one. But... it continued on basically until the Xbox One came into the picture. So where does Summer of Arcade come in where you say, well, let's really put some PR attention behind a block of these in a time when there are no other games coming out? It became such a cool event on Xbox. Summer of Arcade came from and how you went about choosing particularly that original set of Summer of Arcade.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it. Or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Arcade games.
Well, I'll answer the question more broadly and then more specifically. More broadly, Xbox Live Arcade was, again, because of the way it came up and because it was sort of unexpected, it wasn't part of the plan, and we were a separate team, we got to do a lot of cool stuff that was just experiments.
Yeah.
Things that we didn't know if they were going to be successful or not. Xbox Live Arcade Wednesdays came about because it was an experiment. We were trying to do there was a number of reasons, right? We had, you know, Aaron Greenberg, as you know well, Amy Blair, who is a longtime, you know, marketing kind of guru in the industry that's worked at Sega and Sony. She was the head of Xbox Live marketing at the time. she and Aaron and myself and a couple others came up with this idea of Arcade Wednesdays as kind of an opportunity to, again, curate and draw focus and attention to what we consider to be some of the best of the best. We tried to ship an arcade game every week just as a matter of course.
Yeah.
Because we had this tremendous, we had this crush of interest on the consumer side and this crush of interest on the developer side to, like, get us on the platform. So we had to, like, okay, slow it down. So we built this cadence of one game a week. Arcade Wednesdays came about in, okay, well, we ship games on Wednesdays. This is a program that we can put out in the summer of arcades specifically to counter-program against the big fall, you know, obviously the big Q4 releases. At the time, it was mostly about Q4.
Sure.
We've kind of moved a little bit away from that now in more recent years, but at the time, it was all about Q4.
Definitely.
Summer was dead, and we had these amazing games, especially 1 to 2 years into the, you know, ecosystem creation of Xbox Live Arcade. We started getting the Braids and the Limbos and the, you know, the Cloning Clydes and the Shadow Complexes and these games that were not just ports, not just little casual games, but they were, not to say those aren't good, but I mean, really the truly creative, innovative things from these right. little companies that had no money. This was our opportunity to go and showcase those games. And we launched the first one as an experiment, and the thing just took off. I mean, it absolutely took off. It was that promotion, that additional layer of promotion helped to distinguish those titles, help them to stand out, and the developers couldn't be happier. We were hitting million unit, you know, titles on a regular basis, and it just catapulted the service to the next level. So Summer of Arcade just ended up being this massive boon for us. We had many other experiments, too. I mean, we had done, God, I mean, so many experiments. We had Aegis Wing. You guys remember Aegis Wing?
Free game.
Free game. That was a summer intern program. So the challenge
really?
Was, could we hire
students made that?
Three students for 3 months interning in the XBLA group at Microsoft, see if they could make a game. And they did. It was Aegis Wing. Not a bad game for three guys in 3 months. We had, God, we had everything. We had advert games in there with Yaris. We had Burger King. Remember the Burger King?
Oh, there's the Sneak King. It's beloved. It's like a cult classic now.
Yeah. We had, Sneak King, exactly. So we did those three games, kind of specific. Of course,
I don't know how many Whoppers that game sold, but it seems like it moved some, like, people loved that game.
Those games were a huge hit, and people are tracking them down. They're selling on eBay. I mean, people are trying to track down those games. It was an experiment again we did. There were just so many fun things we did. We did poker, Texas Hold'em Poker. Remember?
That was huge.
The Texas Hold'em Poker game, and then we gave it away to try and build a huge community. We had over 1 million downloads of it before we started charging for it, so we had this huge, vibrant community around Texas Hold'em, which was huge at the time.
So when you're lining up that first Summer of Arcade, how are you picking the titles? Because you're like, okay, well, we got to narrow. I think, I don't remember if the first one was 4 or 5. I know later ones were 5 weeks,
yep.
5 games.
5 weeks, 5 games.
How are you? So you got to obviously choose. Well, what's ready or gonna be ready in time?
Yeah.
But then how are you curating from there?
It was more of an art than a science. It's very similar to kind of, you know, if you're familiar with kind of what the Apple guys do and editorializing the iTunes App Store nowadays. They have a team of people that look at the games. We had a portfolio. By the time I'd staffed out my team, early 2007, I had 35 people working on XBLA.
Wow.
We'd grown quite a bit. Again, kind of a weird org because we had a lot of game development, it's like kind of portfolio management and game side of it. We also were doing features in the dash. So we had kind of a back end and a dashboard team and a games team all kind of in one thing, which again was kind of anomalous for Microsoft. But we had a portfolio management group. So there were people that did nothing but think about what games we need, what games, you know, what meeting with developers, figuring out what games we should have on the platform and curating that portfolio. A key component of, and this was another aspect of sort of the business plan that goes all the way back to the beginning, was what I call dimensionalizing the portfolio, making sure that we had in the early stages of ecosystem creation, while you're defining what the experience is for people that aren't familiar with this concept,
sure.
It's important that you have a little something for everybody.
And yeah, so not just all side-scrolling platformers,
right,
for instance.
Right. Or not all card games, or not all Bejeweled clones, or whatever. We wanted to make sure we had a little something for everyone. So, especially with the first 50 games or so, we were doing a lot of that sort of curation in terms of making sure that we represented all of the different genres of the game with high-quality content. Once a thing was off the ground and we really felt like, okay, XBLA is really really, you know, gained traction, we then shifted more into a mode of quality, innovation, more, even more of an indie shift, frankly, a little less about the casual and the retro,
yeah,
which bootstrapped us initially, and a little bit more towards the, you know, the
shadow complexes,
yeah, the braids, the Jonathan Blows, the, you know, working with these talented folks on their vision, in some cases helping them with funding, in some cases not. And then Xbox, the Summer of Arcade program was about the best of the best. It was about taking those titles that we really felt like were platform-defining experiences.
Some of them had to be obvious, right? Like,
some of them
like
were
a Limbo
obvious.
or some of them were absolutely obvious. Yeah.
And it was absolutely obvious to us, as obvious as Geometry Wars was. I mean, Geometry Wars, we knew, we had a strong suspicion out of the 20 that we had initially done that that was our killer app. And I remember, I actually probably still have it someplace, the email I got from Jay, who was, of course, playing on the console every day, and this is pre-launch of the 360. He sends me a note saying, Geometry Wars is killer, man. I can't stop playing it. You're on to something here.
What did Bizarre think of the risk? Because PGR was, that was, of course, 3 was the launch game for 360. PGR 3 is one of, in my opinion, one of the three best of the 16 or so 360 launch titles. Mm-hmm. But then Geometry Wars takes off and becomes this monster of its own, and it was probably made by, you know, 5 of them or something, while 50 more of them worked on PGR. Did it take them, did it take Bizarre Creations by surprise as well?
It did. It took them by surprise, but in a good way. I mean, those guys, that was a poster child for, you know, really interesting sort of secondary phenomenon that occurred with XBLA, which was kind of an unexpected outcome, but one that we were happy about, which is you had a lot of folks, and you still do, right, a lot of really, really talented people in this industry that are working on traditional AAA, you know, content development that are working for 3, 4, 5 years, slaving away 12 hours a day, working on a big game. And at the time, you know, those guys at Bizarre Creations, super talented guys, right? They're slaving away. They're working on PGR 3, and they need a break.
Like, well, they've been doing car games since Metropolis Street Racer. They've been doing car games their whole lives.
Exactly. And some these guys, you know, you've met and interviewed a bunch of them. They're super creative people, and their creativity is not constrained to, I'm only creative with racing games. It's like, no, they're generally creative. They have cool ideas.
Yeah.
And so what XBLA ended up being for folks, a lot of, you know, really talented developers, was a creative outlet that gave them a bit of a break. Low development cost, short development cycle, you know, opportunity for them to stretch their creative legs, do something quick, innovative, fun, try some stuff. And not everything worked. But in the case of Geometry Wars, they came up with this cool idea for a twin stick shooter with these cool vector graphics. And the thing was addictive as all hell. And we were just blown away by this thing.
Well, that's similar. I mean, Shadow Complex from Chair, you know, those guys had spent they'd made this big budget game, Advent Rising, that memory serves, was supposed to be a trilogy, but then didn't. Like, it was actually a very good game, sort of technically problematic, but the game was really fun. I remember reviewing it back in the day, but it didn't commercially do super well. And then they come back, their next game.
Yeah.
I don't think Undertow was first. I think Shadow Complex was first.
So
they come back with Shadow Complex, and then it's this incredible Metroidvania for a new generation that everybody loves.
Yeah, and you know, behind the scenes, and this is one of the perks of being in the position that I was in, was you got to influence the portfolio with your own interests, right? And so, you know, the initial, you know, arcade games we launched with, like, you know, I think I mentioned, you know, Joust and, you know, Robotron was a nod to Jay. It was a thank you to Jay because he was a huge Eugene Jarvis fan. You know, A Joust and Gauntlet were my favorite arcade games growing up, so I naturally picked them for
the Captain's Privilege, right?
Captain's Privilege. And so, you know, when the thing took off, it was sky's the limit, what do you want to do? And so you had all these different influencers, guys like Ken Lobb, you know, and, you know, some of the other folks, in, you know, internally that were all kind of like, wow, it would be really cool if we could do this. And so you had, oh my God, if we could have Marathon on the console, that would be freaking amazing.
Check.
What if we could get Doom, the original Doom, old school, but playable over Xbox Live? Boom. A bunch of us were Magic the Gathering fans. Let's go call up, you know, the Wizards of the guy, the Coast guys, and Stainless, and we do this thing, and boom, first ever, you know, Magic the Gathering multiplayer game on a console. Boom, done. So a bunch of us were huge fans of Metroidvania, you know, and we love that genre. And so there was a huge contingent, like, we need Castlevania on here. Check, we got Castlevania on the. So, and we were like, but we need, like, man, what if we could do an original, you know, kind of Metroidvania game on the console? And Cher comes along, and of course, with this creative vision behind Shadow Conflex, and it was just a natural. But it was this magical time, right? I can't even describe
it was for players, too. I mean, it was just like every summer of arcade, every week there was something new and interesting.
It's a once-in-a-hundred career sort of opportunity.
I ask developers about this a lot. I'm going to ask you now, too, because I have noticed particularly in my professional time in the industry, which I've been doing this for 13 years since the beginning of the original Xbox, I feel like the sort of middle class, the middle tier of games have kind of died. That, you know, things that came out for the original Xbox, things like PsyOps from Midway or Breakdown is one of my all-time favorite cult classics that nobody played. It's this weird first-person melee game where famously in the beginning you like eat this burger and then throw up in first person, but it's this crazy sci-fi game. Like that stuff doesn't get made anymore because I feel like the industry now over the last 5 years or so is like it's a lot like the movie industry actually, where it's these huge mega budget productions or the indie guys.
Yeah.
It's almost like Live Arcade started to rebuild that middle ground. Would you agree with that?
I would. And that's, you know, that's one of the things, a little bit of a bummer. I think it's drifted a little bit over the years, but I mean, I think it absolutely set out to do that, and it absolutely was on a trajectory to doing that. You know, now we've still got, of course, we've got a thriving indie, you know, industry trying amazingly awesome things. I mean, I'm just playing Gone Home and Oxenfree and, you know, and The Witness myself right now. And I'm just astounded by what the industry has done on the indie front in terms of super creative stuff. I think there is that middle ground. You're absolutely right, and you've nailed it on the head. You've hit the nail on the head in terms of that's a really tough market for retail and the publishers right now. It's AAA. It's traditional movie model now, right? It's like art house film or it's Jurassic World.
It's
tentpole sort of franchises. That middle ground is really tough. It exists, you know, that Bridge of Spies or whatever. It's that kind of middle fall release in the Hollywood model. But it's tougher and tougher, and that's why I think XBLA can and should be that in a lot of ways.
Did your team have anything to do with 1 vs. 100? Which is, if you listen to my Xbox podcast every week, you know, huge fan of my. My proudest achievements are my 12 out of 12, all 200 points in 1 vs. 100 because it's literally impossible to get. Did you guys have anything to do with that?
We had something to do with it. There were other people involved in that project as well. What happened at again, I go back to that common theme of the little engine that could. You know, we had staffed up the team. We were pumping out all these great games a couple years into, you know, the 360 life cycle. And, you know, my team was incredibly creative, sort of innovative team. They were builders, not shepherds, right? And so a lot of them wanted to move on to do the next thing. And so we had a lot of ideas we tossed around internally about sort of programming inside of Xbox Live and live events and things that were kind of offshoots, leveraging Xbox Live Arcade for distribution and then being more sort of episodic or other things. And so 1 vs. 100 was born out of that. So a number of members of my team went over and worked with some others that weren't on the team to actually make 1 vs. 100 happen. And we had some bigger plans for that as well. I'm really sorry that it's no longer on the services. I love that.
Please tell me you can tell me what these bigger plans were that never saw the light of day.
I love the game. I'm not really sure kind of what's still kind of under wraps within
Fair
Microsoft.
Enough.
I don't want to violate anything. But
I asked.
But I would. but I'll tell you that there were a lot of really great ideas internally. And you know what? Phil was there. Phil's been there every step of the way. Has always been a supporter of Live Arcade. I love Phil. He's aware of some of the things that we were working on. And you know, you never know with Phil. I mean, maybe he'll.
I'll ask
some
him
of those
next
ideas
chance
out.
I get.
Yeah.
So, give me, pick your favorite child. What was your all-time favorite Live Arcade game?
Man, that is like picking a favorite child. I would say it would have to be Limbo. I think Limbo is probably my favorite game. It was the absolute embodiment of what I and others had envisioned when we had birthed Xbox Live Arcade. It was indie game, totally creative, harkened back to kind of mechanics that were known in the industry at the time, but a completely fresh take, super creative, small.
Couldn't be done at retail.
Couldn't be done at retail. That game would never exist in a million years at retail. 3-4 hours long, amazing experience. Production quality was awesome. Totally resonated on every level. And I'm just so proud of developers like that, that were able to come up with such innovative and creative content and really help Xbox Live Arcade realize the potential of what it could be.
Well, and Playdead's got, we're still waiting to see more of Inside. If you got any connections, any inside connections,
inside connections,
please, we need to see that game as soon as possible. Was there a game that you were trying to get for Live Arcade that got away? Do you have any like sort of ones that got away from you that didn't end up getting on Live Arcade for whatever reason?
That's a great question. There were a lot of games that we wanted to do around board gaming. Again, this is a personal bias. I'm a big strategy board gamer. It's why
does that explain
Ticket to Ride and
Carcassonne?
Carcassonne, yeah. Catan. We had a vision for actually making that kind of the platform of choice for multiplayer board gaming over Xbox Live. There were a number of franchises we tried to get that we couldn't get for whatever rights reason. That was challenging for us. We didn't really lose out to Sony. I mean, now it's different, but at the time, you know, PS3 and PSN was kind of playing catch up. They had done some amazing, you know, stuff on the original content side, obviously with Flow and some of the
Flower,
titles they'd done
yeah.
that they'd Flower that they'd published first party, that obviously we didn't have access to. But they were kind of a couple years behind in terms of catching up, and they were getting games that we already had, and we were leading for a while. Now I think it's different, right? Now I think there are a number of games, and I'm just frankly a little bummed that, you know, the industry we really created on Xbox, you know, that they're not premiering on Xbox.
Yeah, because you, so. to clarify, you left Microsoft in 2007?
2007, yeah.
2007,
yep.
So
yep.
you've been sort of watching the Xbox and the industry, which you're still in, but you've been watching from outside Microsoft since 2007.
That's right. Yep.
Let's talk about that. I mean, it's to me as a longtime Xbox gamer and somebody who covered Xbox for a long time, I've lamented. I've written editorials about, you know, I just don't. It's head scratching to me why Microsoft abandoned Live Arcade entirely. It's games are games, and they're all thrown in.
Yeah.
The $10 whatever ID title is thrown in with on the same digital marketplace space with Halo 5.
Yeah.
So what have you seen out of how the indie space is on both consoles, both the Xbox One and the PS4 these days?
Yeah, I mean to be honest with you, it's been a little bit of a bummer to me in more recent years, especially since Xbox One, that they, you know, some of the developers have chosen to, you know, head PlayStation's way first. I mean, I think some of that stuff's coming back around, which is great. You know, they're publishing afterwards, but and of course there are exceptions to that, like Ori and the Blind Forest, which is one of my all-time favorite games, probably my top three on Xbox One so far, which is
Cuphead's
been phenomenal. Cuphead,
Inside,
I'm super excited
mentioned.
About Inside. Yeah. There are exceptions to that certainly, but you know, there are a lot of games that I'm a little bummed. You know, The Witness being one of them. Obviously, Jonathan Blow and what he's done, you know, with Braid, what he did with Braid, which was fantastic, and then the follow-up has been phenomenal. Not having that premiere on Xbox, you know, my heart and soul is still, you know, I'm still an Xbox guy at heart. That's a bit of a bummer, you know. Firewatch, you know, there are other games that I'm a little bummed about. I think it's, you know, I have to tip my hat to Sony. I mean, I think that Sony has really done a really great job. You know, Adam and the, you know, the guys there at Sony have really done a good job courting indies and really, you know, part of it's been that focus on gamers, and I think that's really resonated with the indies. But I think they've also done a really good job courting and developing that space. I think there's, on the Xbox side, I think, you know, my era, which is more the Peter Moore era, right? I worked for Peter. Was a slightly different era. I think it's come back around with Phil. I think it's come full circle, and Phil's awesome, and Phil is a gamer, and he gets it. And I think he's turning the ship back around, and some of the things I'm seeing, whether it's back and pad, and seeing the joy I have, whatever seems like every couple of weeks, I pop up the dash, and more of my XBLA games are lit up.
I was just playing Doom, play. Doom 1, backwards compatible, like, on my Xbox One the other night.
Absolutely love it, right? And just in a more general sense, I think Phil is just on track. He's a gamer. He's a passionate hardcore gamer like I am, and he gets it, and he's turning the ship back around. But I think there was a while there where, you know, I think, you know, the service maybe lost its way a little bit. I think
gone. It's still not there in the way it was. There are no Live Arcade Wednesdays. Yeah. You know, if you were still there,
it's drifted.
If you were still there, what would you be pushing for?
I think it goes back to what I said earlier about sort of Xbox Live Arcade having a very clear vision for what it was and what it wasn't, right? Dedicated destination for your collection and for the marketplace, and being able to find that content, surface that content. You know, every game has a demo. It's about indie games, small games, casual games. It's about lower price points. It's about these specific things, and it's not about these things. And the vision for Arcade was a very crisp vision when I was there. And I think what's happened is, and I won't just say it's me. There's, you know, a lot of people, again, a lot of really smart people that worked on XBLA, and a lot of people that continued to hold the, you know, carry the mantle forward even after I left, you know, the Minecraft phenomenon, and that's title's incredible success, and many of the other titles that were published after I left. I think it drifted somewhat into some of those areas that were a little more vague and a little more ambiguous, right? Drifting away from a dashboard standpoint, away from the dedicated destination, and towards, you know, the NXE, it still had kind of an Arcade banner, and there was still an area.
Yeah.
But then with Xbox One, I think there were just a lot of people, philosophically, there's some people, I hear this a lot, like games are games are games. I disagree with that. I don't believe that. I hear that a lot from some people, and I heard it especially a couple years ago from the Xbox One management team at the time, not Phil, but some of the earlier folks, that, you know, all games are the same. They just should be dumped in the same area. I just philosophically do not agree with that. The concept of curation, the concept of really showcasing and democratizing gaming, showcasing indie games that deserve attention, that are just going to be drowned out by $100 million marketing campaigns and, you know, and big retail console releases when they're sitting alongside them in an app store that's already too cluttered. We always have had the issue from the inception of Xbox 360 in 2005. There was already an issue from day one of cluttered marketplace.
If you go back and read the articles, went away ultimately, right? They just couldn't handle it.
It couldn't accommodate it. NXE kind of got better there, but the App Store faces this on iTunes as well, right? And the iOS App Store and Android, you know, Google Play faces this. It's this concept of the pendulum swings. Oh, you know what? We'll just dump millions of titles in there, and we'll let everybody. It's cool. Everybody, we'll just have a great search engine. Everybody will find the great stuff. No, that's not correct. It's really about curation. And what you've seen with Apple, as an example, because they're the big dog right now, right, in terms of digital distribution and digital marketplaces, let's face it, they have an order of magnitude more, you know, apps or more than Xbox has or PlayStation has. What you see is you see them moving back towards curation. So you see more of an active editorial team picking and choosing the games that are good that people might want to see and surfacing those in the interface. Xbox needs to do the same thing. And I think they moved away from that over the years, gradually in 360, and then with Xbox One, I think there was, again, some philosophical differences about what's a game is a game is a game. I think there were some philosophical differences, or maybe just a loss of understanding around what the original vision for Xbox Live Arcade was and wasn't, and what that brand stood for. And I think it's drifted. But again, I'm encouraged by the last year that I think there are indications that you know, the ship is turning.
So this is why I love that you came in. You came prepared with notes. You brought notes with you. You, like, clearly Live Arcade meant just still, it was, you said it was 7 years of your life, that it still matters to you and you still just love it. Like, it, how many people that worked on something can say that? I mean, it's, because you've worked at Blizzard, you've worked at Activision, you've worked at PopCap.
Right.
These are not insignificant companies.
Yeah.
Would you say that your time with Live Arcade has been the most rewarding time of your career?
Oh, it's absolutely was. Without a doubt, it was a special time. And I love the other companies I worked for. I've been fortunate enough to work with some really amazing people, had some amazing mentors throughout my career, and been able to work with great people. You know, Rob Pardo at Blizzard, or you know, some of the great people at Activision, or you know, Jason Kapalka at PopCap, or you know, really amazing people, you know, visionaries, amazing creative people, and done some really cool things. Been fortunate enough to really work on some really great teams. Xbox Live Arcade is the type of thing that occurs once in 100 lifetimes. It is the right place, the right time, the right idea, the right team, executed. It was right in front of everybody's face, but no one saw it. You did it, and it just exploded. And, you know, because it was so successful, and because it was so financially meaningful to the company, and because it resonated from a marketing and a press standpoint so much, it opened doors personally, professionally, for me, for the team. It opened doors in terms of the indie community. I firmly believe the indie community would not be here in the way it is today without Xbox Live Arcade, and even the App Store. You know, even the mobile app stores wouldn't be where they are today if it wasn't for this service and the great people that worked on this. And so, it's just, how often do you have? I didn't tell you the story about Bill Gates. I mean, like,
oh, Bill Gates G, story. I've got time for that.
Yeah, I mean, Bill,
these are always good.
Bill G himself. So Bill, he was known as Bill G internally. Sorry, that's a little Microsoftism there. But Bill was. These were kind of the waning years of Bill's time at Microsoft. He left in 2008. He was chief software architect at the time. But you know, he's not a guy, you know, it's pretty well known, right? He's not a real gamer, per se. He's not a hardcore gamer. He greenlit the OG Xbox, you know, back, you know, many years ago, as Robbie writes about in his book, because of, you know, Sony and owning the living room,
right.
And we've heard all about that. And over the years, he was monitoring Xbox, you know, OG Xbox, was supportive of it from a distance, not super involved in that. Same thing with the 360 wave. Xbox Live Arcade hit with Bill. And so you talk about, I mean, talk about an honor. I mean, to be in the presence of...
You got God on your side at that point,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, I mean,
right?
Come on. This
as far
is the guy,
as Microsoft is concerned.
This is the guy, perhaps one of the most influential people in the history of the world that has, at least the modern world.
Sure, and, 20th century.
And I had the privilege of meeting with him multiple times because he asked for the meeting with me, little me, off to the side, in the some corner of Microsoft, and some little, you know, little engine that could team. You know, he asked Robbie, and Robbie asked me to you know, to meet with Bill because of Xbox Live Arcade. So he had took several meetings with me over the course of a couple years. He was personally interested in Xbox Live Arcade for a number of reasons. Number one, it was broadening the console. It was bringing in, you know, different sorts of games. But number two, he personally was a casual gamer. He loved Zuma, in particular. And so he wanted to actually give feedback on the experience. His kids were little at the time. And so he said, this is actually something, the first time I can play with my kids at home on the weekend. We can actually play games together.
Did he tell you specifically what about that game he loved?
Oh, he loves it. And Bill is probably the single most brilliant person I've ever met in my entire life. Like, he is at a different like a Stephen Hawking level of intelligence, and he, you think a guy like Bill Gates that's running a, you know, at the time was the world's most valuable company that has 300-400 product units across Windows, Office, $10 billion SKUs, crazy technology complexity going on. You'd think that he wouldn't know very much about the little game stuff in the corner, let alone Xbox, let alone Xbox Live Arcade.
Right.
This guy comes in the very first time I sit down with him, and he's rattling off titles, feedback on the dashboard, ideas for feature innovation, things we hadn't rolled out yet, friends, leaderboards, other things, and was giving me feedback for PopCap, which at the time was a partner,
right,
on Zuma, on Zuma's mechanics. He is actually the guy that came up with the colorblind mode, because he's colorblind. The colorblind mode that actually we ended up implementing in all of the all the PopCap games, most of the XBLA games that were color dependent. And then when I went to PopCap some years later, ended up implementing that feature into all of our games there as well, based on that. And Robbie even invited me. I mean, you talk about a once in a hundred lifetimes opportunity. I mean, he invited me to this offsite. So once a year, like all the big Microsoft, the senior execs like Jeff Rakes and Eric Rutter and these guys that are running titans of industry in and of themselves all get together with Bill and Steve, you know, at the time, once a year to this big executive retreat. And Robbie invited little me to fly like on this little private plane off to some, I can't remember where it was, to this offsite to present Xbox Live Arcade to the management of Microsoft Corporation. And I was just like, it's the type of thing, again, it's the type of thing I'm just blessed. I can't say enough about it. And the team that I worked with, some of those talented people that I've ever had the pleasure of working with.
So we all fondly remember Live Arcade, and we're saying we can bring it back, right?
We can.
We can bring it back.
We
Wednesdays,
can.
Trial versions, Summer of Arcade.
Curate it.
It's right there, right?
It's right there. I mean, first of all, bring back the brand. I mean, the brand, I was racking my brain in preparation for this as to, I think that is probably the most financially and commercially successful brand, at least in the last 10 years of consoles, that has been decommissioned. Like, that is a multi-hundred million dollar brand with tons of equity amongst 50 million gamers. I don't understand why it's not there. I just don't get it. So bring back the brand. Like you said, dedicated destination in the dash, easily fixable, right?
They got tabs.
Create an area in the marketplace, the new Xbox One experience, which is great. Create an area there for, you know, discoverability. Create an area of My Games and Apps, a filter or an area where you can view your digital games collection. Curation, Xbox Live Arcade, you know, Summer of Arcade and Xbox Live Arcade Wednesdays. Bring that back. Every game has a demo. Again, they've started to do it.
A little bit.
A little bit here and there. Like, let's bring that back. I mean, these are all, I mean, just constructive feedback. I mean, it's just, you know, for the guys, they're doing such a phenomenal job on Xbox One. And again, I have nothing but respect for Phil and the team. They could make some very easy decisions and bring back a brand that gives them a point of real differentiation versus their competitors in the console space by just doing some really easy things. And bring back that audience that everybody loves. And then with Backcompat, you didn't lose your library. I mean, just focus on, like they have been, bringing back and lighting up those games in the dashboard. Of course, there's 725 XBLA games now, so maybe not all of them, but at least the biggest ones.
Curate those. Got to curate
those.
Right?
Prioritize those. Bring them back. And boy, God, you'd have just a huge, you know, let's face it, it's a trench war right now with the services, right? PlayStation Network's come a long way.
Absolutely.
They've got a phenomenal experience on PlayStation 4. Nothing but respect for those guys. I spent a lot of time on my PS4 as well. The new Xbox One experience has come a long way over the shipping
Metro,
experience, the Metro experience. And they're looking for points of distinction, for differentiation right now. You know, there's Games with Gold and the you know, the PlayStation equivalent. They're looking for these different points of distinction. Xbox Live Arcade is a huge, huge, you know, bullet in the chamber, whatever analogy you want to use. It's a huge point of distinction. And it can help to balance out the advantage, I think, that Sony has right now on the indie side, certainly.
Clearly, so if Microsoft picks up the phone and calls you and tells you, please come back and do this again, think about it. But there it is.
I appreciate that.
Greg Kinesa, the creator of Xbox Live Arcade, saying, Microsoft, bring it back. I completely agree with you 100%, by the way. I just can't think. I love your passion and enthusiasm for this thing that you don't even work on anymore.
Thank you.
I appreciate that so much. Thanks for coming in and telling us all
thank
about
you for inviting me.
Live Arcade. It was great. You also brought a bunch of Live Arcade memorabilia. We're going to photograph it, put an article on IGN. You have physical patents.
Yeah.
And original trophies and original promotional materials. So that's going to be a separate thing on IGN. Please look for that, as well as other episodes of IGN Unfiltered. Greg Kinesa, creator of Xbox Live Arcade, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you to everybody.
Hey folks, I'm Yen.
And I'm Nat.
And we're the hosts of Comic Sans, the podcast about comics for those who are sans knowledge.
Comic Sans is a show for people who know nothing about comics, like me.
And people who love them, like me, and want to learn more about them.
What makes you an authority on comic books?
I read them, write them, live them, breathe them. What makes you the authority on knowing nothing?
Honestly, Yen, 2 seasons in, I actually know a little more than I used to.
You're welcome. The reason for that is that every episode I make Nat read one of my favorite comics, like Daredevil Saga or This One Summer.
And then he tells me what makes that comic so special.
And then I hear what Nat thinks and I try to avoid a pulmonary embolism.
While I actively try to give him one.
You can listen to the second season of Comic Sans now.
With new episodes every 2 weeks.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, Yen, I think I know so much about comics now that this might have to be our last season.
Nat, there will forever be more comic than you will ever know.
What does that even mean?
I don't know. It sounds profound though, right?